Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. When you conjure up the Dead Sea in your mind, your first thoughts may be about the famous Dead Sea Scrolls, ancient religious texts found in a cave near the sea that's one of the saltiest bodies of water on the planet and the lowest point of elevation on the surface of the Earth. Renowned for centuries for its purported healing and restorative powers, the sea, which is bordered by Israel on the west and Jordan in the east, is a place where stories in the Bible, like the tale of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, are set. But diversions of the water feeding into the Dead Sea and climate change are drastically lowering water levels there, leading to catastrophic sinkholes and dramatic erosion. A plan to remedy the situation by pumping waters from the nearby Red Sea, desalinating them for drinking water, and then feeding the leftover brine into the Dead Sea has been developed by scientists, engineers, and activists in the region, which is desperately in need of more fresh water, while also wanting to preserve the ancient sea. A new PBS Nova documentary, Saving the Dead Sea, will air on April 24th, and it tells the story of the plans to geoengineer a remedy for both the sea and the need for more fresh water in the region. We're joined by the two makers of the film, science documentary filmmakers Terry Randall and Avner Tavori. Randall has produced several Nova documentaries for PBS, including films about the New Horizons mission to Pluto. Tavori, who grew up in Israel visiting the Dead Sea as a child, worked closely with Randall in the making of the film. Both of them joined us from New York via Skype. Terry Randall and Avner Tavori, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I watched the film a couple of times now and just loved it. There's just so many superlatives associated with the Dead Sea. You know, it's the lowest place on Earth. It's one of the saltiest bodies of water. And the incredible history of it stretching back to antiquity. I'd like to start out by asking you guys, what was the genesis, and that seems like an appropriate word to use in this context, what was the genesis of this project that made you guys want to do a documentary about the Dead Sea and what's going on there?
Avner, you want to take this one?
Well, you know, I was born in Israel. I was raised in Israel. And for me, the Dead Sea was a part of my childhood, of my growing up in Israel. And I kind of knew over the years what's happening there, and especially in the last 10 years or so, that it was really an accelerated withdrawal of the water. And I thought it's an interesting story to put it in the larger context of what's happening in the Middle East and the water issue in the Middle East. And I brought it up, and I convinced Terry that it's a good idea, and that's how it was born, basically.
Well, Terry, can you share with us, you know, what's the basic problem? What's going on? Why is this an issue that you guys decided to tackle? Because it really is an incredible story of environmental catastrophe going on there.
Well, I think you need, in a way, you need to see it. The first time I went to the Dead Sea, I was 16, and there were no sinkholes that I recall seeing. And it was a very different experience. And the impact of seeing it is profound. You really get a sense of the change. And I felt that when people visit the Dead Sea now, they're taken to the Southern Basin. And I don't think most of them realize what's happening in the northern part of the sea. And I think it's a very important story to tell because it's being overlooked, and people who care about this region and care about this history that you talked about should know about what's happening there.
Avner, you mentioned that you used to go there as a youngster. Could you tell us, you know, tell us about your first experience there and what that place meant to you as a young person? Describe it for us, because for a lot of Americans, they have no idea what the Dead Sea is other than they've heard of the scrolls, and that's about it.
Well, I think the first time I went down there was probably as a young kid, like maybe 12, 13, 14 with my family. And, you know, the Dead Sea, I mean, the first time you see the Dead Sea is you drive down the road that goes down towards it, you drive in a desert, and you drive in the desert, and you drive in the desert, and all of a sudden, this thing appears kind of like way below you, and it's all blue and it's magnificent. And you get down there, the weather is very strange down there. I mean, because of the because of the level, because of the intensity of the minerals in the air, it feels kind of like out of this world type of a place. It's kind of weird when you're there, and it's very beautiful. It's and the sea at the time reached almost the bottom of the mountains around it. So you walked around, you can drive on the road or you can walk by the road, and you're right there by the Dead Sea. And it was very salty. I mean, of course, you know, everyone did this experience of walking into the water and being lifted up by the water, because you can't sink into the water. And you just lie flat on the top of the water and you can hardly move.
Yeah, that's one of the few things that I knew before I watched this documentary and started to learn more about the Dead Sea, which I find fascinating, you know, on so many levels, is that, you know, I just remember it's the place you can go and you cannot sink. You can just float there. And it just seemed like, wow, that's a magical place.
It is.
Could you describe for us what's going on there? Why is the Dead Sea receding so dramatically? And we'll later on we'll get into the sinkholes and some of those phenomena. But why is the Dead Sea receding?
Well, it's a long story. I mean, basically the demise of the Dead Sea started in the early 1960s. When Israel blocked the mouth of the River Jordan, that was like the main supplier of water to the Dead Sea, in order to divert water into the national water carrier. So a big amount of water that used to go down to the Dead Sea was diverted. A few years later, Jordan, on its part, blocked or put a dam on the Yarmouk River, which was another source of water that went down the Jordan River to the Dead Sea. So for many, many years, the main source of water to the Dead Sea was blocked and diverted elsewhere. And that was the only source of water to replenish the Dead Sea. And its high rate of evaporation. I mean, the water evaporates. You can imagine, you know, it's a big lake. It's a terminal lake, and it's hot down there. And there's an escalated rate of evaporation that used to be replenished by water coming through the Jordan River. And when the water's not coming for the Jordan River, then the sea started slowly, slowly to shrink. The process accelerated in the last 10, 15 years, I think because of the topography of the region. I mean, it first receded just a little bit, and then it kind of like plunged further down. The other part of it is the industrial harvesting of the potash at the southern basin that is been accelerated over the year. I mean, it's a major industry down there, both on the Israeli side and on the Jordanian side, of harvesting potash from the Dead Sea. And in order to do that, the whole southern basin of the Dead Sea has been transformed into evaporation ponds, and it's been dried out.
But there's also the issue of climate change, because researchers are beginning to look into how much climate change is accelerating the process. And many of the scientists told us that the process is happening faster than they anticipated because of climate change, combined with all these other aspects that Avner was talking about.
I'm curious, when did you start work on this documentary? When was the inception of this?
Well, we did the major filming in April of last year, and it took us about a year, maybe more than a year and a half, prior to developing it and doing the research. It took about maybe a couple of years.
And when you make a program for NOVA, and I know, Terry, you've made some of my favorites, especially the ones about Pluto, like the Pluto Files with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and the recent one about the flyby of Ultima Thule. When you decide to make a NOVA program, tell us a little bit about the process that you go through. That, okay, I've got an idea that I think this would be good for NOVA. How does that work?
Well, we discuss a lot the idea, and if NOVA's interested, we do a lot of research, and NOVA's take a lot of research. And then if we go into production on it, the research continues, the fact-checking continues. It's a very intense process because we feel it's our responsibility to get the science right. And it's also a process for me of first understanding the science and then figuring out a way to distill it so other people can understand it. So it takes time to... takes a lot of time to figure it out.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the science. One of the things that I picked up on watching this is like a chemistry experiment on the grandest scale you can imagine. Can you tell us a little bit about the unique chemistry of the waters were involved in the Dead Sea, and then the idea of taking water from the Red Sea and desalinating it and then putting the brine in there, because the chemistry behind all this is quite fascinating.
Well, and for the scientists, it's a real challenge because these two bodies of water are so different. I mean, they're both salty water, but nothing compares to the salt of the Dead Sea. It's so extraordinary. And, you know, in the lab, scientists are trying to figure out, can you really do this without doing harm? Are you going to do more harm than good? And even in the lab, if you could figure out the right formula, how much Red Sea brine or water can be added to the Dead Sea, when you do it on a large scale, you don't know what's going to happen. You can't know what's going to happen until you do it. And that's a concern for the scientists.
I can just throw in a number for you. So like the percentage of salt in the Red Sea is about 7%. And the concentration of salt in the Dead Sea is about 35%. So you imagine that such a huge difference between the two types of water. And you know, the Red Sea is kind of is connected to all the oceans of the world. The Dead Sea is not. And you take water from the Red Sea and mix it with water of the Dead Sea, there's a lot of things that you don't know. I mean, the temperature has an effect on it. The air pressure has an effect on it. The sun has an effect of it. All those ingredients do not show up in the lab when you just mix the water in a lab and see what happens. So the scientists are very cautious. I mean, even though they did the experiment and they say that, you know, that it's reasonably safe to do that, they also say that there's a lot of ingredients that will show up only if you do it real on a large scale and you don't really know what's going to happen.
That's why they want to do it slowly as well, because they want to cautiously take what they've learned in the lab and apply it to the real world. If they do too much, they're concerned they'll see a negative response. So if they start small and build up, they can see the transition from lab into the real world. And if they need to make adjustments, they can make adjustments then.
One of the things I found fascinating from a chemistry standpoint was that in the Dead Sea, you have lots of calcium ions in the water. And in the Red Sea, you have lots of sulfate, which is a combination of sulfur with four oxygen atoms attached. That's the sulfate ion. And those two ions really like to join together and make calcium sulfate, which is gypsum, which is a white salt. And, you know, what I saw in your show that was just fascinating was the idea of what if this started to turn into the White Sea?
It could be the White Sea, or algae could turn it into the Red Sea. And would that be something amazing to see? Yes. Would you want to float in it? Maybe not.
Yeah.
What's interesting about that, which they don't know, is that depending on the size of the crystals, they may float to the surface and then the sea will turn white. If they're a little bigger, they may not float all the way up to the surface and then it will not turn white. But you don't know, because it depends on all these other factors. If you mix the seas together, when you do it in the lab and you shake it in your hand, you get white. But that's not exactly how it happens in the real world.
Yes, when you're geoengineering on a scale like this, there's, you know, always the possibility of unintended consequences.
That's for sure.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue our conversation with filmmakers Terry Randall and Avner Tavori. Their new NOVA documentary, Saving the Dead Sea, airs April 24th on PBS. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue our visit with two filmmakers, Terry Randall and Avner Tavori, as we talk about their upcoming NOVA documentary, Saving the Dead Sea. I'd like you to share with us, as filmmakers, tell us a story about maybe some of your favorite places to film, some places that really stuck out with you that were just, because some of the cinematography in this is stunning. These places, like you said, Avner, is it just otherworldly looking. Could you tell us about maybe some of your favorite places that you filmed?
Well, the Dead Sea itself is just, well, you've been there, you know, it's just an extraordinary place. And everywhere you look, especially with the sinkholes, it's hard to imagine until you see it, what a sight it is. But also filming in the Middle East and going to Jordan and meeting the Waterwise women was an amazing experience because of their energy in trying to solve the problems with their water shortage.
Well, let's talk about them because Jordan, in particular, they're pumping out their groundwater at a rate that's not sustainable. Could you tell us about that situation and those remarkable women?
Well, basically, we went north close to the Syrian border to where a lot of these women are working and where there is a severe water shortage. And it was interesting because, in a way, the water shortage was giving these women an opportunity to do something they might not normally be able to do. And they are learning a skill. And some of them are taking that skill out into the real world and starting businesses. But I think it gives them a sense that they have some level of control over solving this problem. People there, when water is running, they have all kinds of ways that they're storing it because there's just not enough to go around.
And one of the things I really found fascinating at the beginning of the program, and it's just classic Nova to me, is you get this wonderful history lesson about the Dead Sea and things that I didn't know. And I've never been to the Dead Sea, by the way. I've never been to the Middle East. There was some interesting things in there. Could you tell us, maybe doing the research on this and your team doing research, I imagine, what were some things you found that you were discoveries for you, something that you learned doing research on this?
Well, it's a good question. I knew about the medicinal aspect of the Dead Sea from the times I had visited. And I knew about the mud, because anyone who goes down to the Dead Sea slaps on some mud. So these are things that I knew about. I didn't know Cleopatra was interested in it, but I knew that it went way back. And the biblical connection, I've known forever. So I don't know, Avner, if there was any aspect culturally that was new for you.
I don't know. You know, I knew a lot about the Dead Sea because I grew up there and I grew up on the history. And for me, like, you know, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls was a real event that I witnessed, you know, as a kid when they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it was a big event. And I visited the Dead Sea many, many times because, you know, I lived for many years in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem down to the Dead Sea, it's a short drive. So I was more familiar with it, and I felt that, you know, doing the research, I was, and many times I felt that I was a resource, you know, because I knew how to connect the dots and what people we want to find to tell the story.
And that's one of the things I really loved about this program, is it's so rich, because there, you've got the historical background, you've got the environmental issues, you've got the interesting chemistry going on. But you guys know about this, but our listeners likely don't. Tell us about these resorts that were all along the Dead Sea that you probably went to. And, you know, the people that go there for the health benefits, you know, why do people want to go to the Dead Sea? Because for most people who aren't familiar with it, you know, a trip to the Dead Sea sounds like, you know, a lot of people here are like, let's go to Death Valley. Well, why would you want to go there? Death Valley is actually a wonderful place. I have some friends that just came back from there, and it's analogous in many ways to that region. Tell us about the health resorts along the Dead Sea.
Medical tourism industry that works around the Dead Sea, because it's been known for many years that the Dead Sea water and the Dead Sea climate and being in the Dead Sea or around it is treats a lot of skin conditions. And a lot of Europeans, like, you know, the health insurance in Europe covers, if you have a skin condition, then they cover a trip to the Dead Sea as a medical expense. And there are many, many, many Europeans that suffer from skin disorders that come to the Dead Sea because it has been proven to work for many of the conditions.
Wow. So you can, like, get a prescription to take a trip to the Dead Sea.
Absolutely. If you're in Europe, you can. I don't know if you can do it here, but in Europe, you can, because it's been proven to be effective. And there are people that go there, the people that suffer from severe, you know, skin conditions, they go there for years. They go every year. They go and they spend there like 10, 12 years, and the symptoms go away until next year. And that's their medical treatment.
Elizabeth Lightman, who we featured in the program, has been going there since she was 14. And she goes about once a year. She stays for a few weeks. And she starts actually by just sitting in the shade, because of the minerals in the air start to actually help her with a skin disorder. And she then will venture into the sun, and you're so low that you can spend a little bit more time in the sun because harmful rays are much less there. And then she can venture into the water, which has all the minerals. And the combination of the air and the water and the sun really is wonderful for conditions like eczema and psoriasis. And a lot of people do go there. I had an Israeli cousin who would go there once a year and come back with skin that was okay until the next year.
Wow. Well, and the, you know, because of the elevation being 1,400 feet below sea level, you know, the air pressure there is much greater. And I can see how, you know, with the minerals, as you say, in the air, and you're under more air pressure, you know, that's a really unique place on Earth.
Very. That's why people will go there for the medicinal, for the help with these skin conditions. I actually don't know if there are other places where you can go to do this. That research I haven't done.
Yeah, I'm not. The Dead Sea is unique. I mean, the composition of the minerals and the chemicals with the air quality and with the sun and is very unique. So I don't think that you get exactly the same results in other places. You may. I mean, they also, you know, I mean, the a lot of the stuff like the mud and some of this is imported, so you can actually buy it. But it's not the same. I mean, they say, when we met with the medical people down there who treat the people, they say that the water and the mud is only one part of it. And just being there at the air quality, the pressure of the air, and the filtered sun that gets down there, which is different than what you get from sun in exposure at sea level, is also very important.
Yeah, it's got to be just absolutely unique. You know, there's a place in California that's kind of analogous to this called Mono Lake. And the story of Mono Lake reminds me of this story because Mono Lake is an inland sea. It's very saline. And the city of Los Angeles diverted water away from it, and it started to disappear, and the alkali dust started to blow throughout the region, and they had to go to court and lawsuits against the city of Los Angeles to get them to restore the water. But the water there is not the kind of medicinal mineral water that you find at the Dead Sea. It's sodium hydroxide, which is like lye. You know, you don't want to get in that water. Just if you have any kind of scratch or anything on your body, it stings. It's great for maybe washing clothes, but as far as health benefits, not so great. But there was another thing I found interesting looking at the region of the Dead Sea is it looks very much to me like places along the San Andreas Fault in California. And as I started to research this, I found out it's exactly like that. It's a transform boundary. It's an actual plate boundary region and a very interesting place geologically. Did you interview any scientists that, you know, gave you any insights into what the unique geology of that place is?
Well, Shmulik Marko has been studying the geology for quite a long time. And we went down there with him and went through a region right next to the Dead Sea where you could see layers of history in the surrounding rocks. And you could see the history of earthquakes in the surrounding rocks. And that's what he's studying is the geology of that region.
It's it's part of the big Syrian-African break or rift, the Syrian-African rift that goes all the way from northern Syria all the way down to Africa. So this is where the fault line is. So where the Dead Sea is exactly where the fault line is, and it's actually an opening in the fault line between the two plates, the two moving plates, the African plates and the Arabian plate.
Yeah, I found that fascinating. Just looking at it on Google Earth, I was so reminded of the topography of places along the San Andreas Fault, which are tectonically absolutely similar.
But one thing that what happened at the Dead Sea, which Shmulik was explaining to us, is that over millions and millions and millions of years, water came in from the Mediterranean, it dried up. Water came in from the Mediterranean, it dried up. So, and then it became eventually a terminal lake, which is how it built. That's supply of minerals plus the nature of the rocks surrounding it. So it was a combination of very unique circumstances that created that sea.
Yeah, and the ancient earthquakes too. And of course, there's the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is definitely part of the story of the Dead Sea, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
The area is prone for earthquakes. I mean, there have been many, many earthquakes over the years. And I mean, back in ancient times and also in modern times, I mean, there have been big earthquakes. And this area has tremors all the time. I mean, you know, at one point, somebody says in the film that there was one day that there was 100 little tremors that were recorded in the area, because the plates move all the time. There's little movement, and every little movement creates an earthquake.
You are listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll resume our conversation with Terry Randall and Avner Tavori. Their new film, Saving the Dead Sea, airs on PBS's Nova on April 24th. Stay with us. Let's get back now to our visit with filmmakers Terry Randall and Avner Tavori as we talk about their new PBS Nova documentary, Saving the Dead Sea. Can you tell us about maybe a couple of scientists that stand out in your mind that you interviewed that you just really enjoyed listening to them share their work with you? Could you maybe share some profiles with one or two of them with us?
Well, Amatya Janin, who... we met at the Red Sea and took us out on the sea, is an extraordinary researcher. And his passion for saving the coral reefs is palpable. And on that aspect of the research for the project, he collaborated with Jordanian scientists, and together they came up with a solution to the problem. Because he acknowledged the human need for water and acknowledged the need to preserve nature. And how can you balance the two, which is a hard balance. And so they looked really hard to find a solution for the problem and found that if you pump water into the desalination plant that they need to provide water to the Dead Sea, if you pump at a certain level down far enough, you won't harm the coral reefs. And so I thought that was a really smart solution, and one in which he was balancing the needs of nature and the needs of humanity.
It's just to clarify, I think the problem is that if you build a desalination plant in Aqaba to provide water for Jordan and then move the brine into the Dead Sea, the question is, where do you pump the water from in the Red Sea? And their research showed that if you pump the water from the surface, you will destroy the coral reef. If you pump the water deep below the surface, and I think the number they came up was like 400 meters, then you kind of pump the water below the food line of the coral reef, and that will make sure that the coral reef is not destroyed in the process. The problem, as he mentioned, is the cost. I mean, if you pump water from the surface, it's one thing. If you need to go down 400 meters to pump the water, you get into a pretty expensive endeavor.
Yeah, because it's much more difficult to get that kind of pressure to pump water up from depth.
And it's a construction. I mean, you know, you need to build a whole pumping infrastructure way below sea level, and that's complicated and expensive.
Actually, it might actually be easier, but as you said, more expensive. And you know, you're just mentioning the coral reefs. I had no idea that there were these beautiful coral reefs in the Red Sea, and that those are some of the few reefs that are not being bleached by the acidification of the oceans. So those really are precious places on the planet.
Well, you know, the Red Sea is one of the top destinations for scuba diving for coral reefs. And it goes all the way down from the Gulf of Aqaba, all the way along the shores of the Red Sea, all the way down. And it's, we went down there at one time, and you can even snorkel. You know, it's just an amazing coral reef there. And the concern is, you know, if you start building there and you start creating all kind of changes to the environment, that will affect the coral reef.
But also as temperatures rise, that coral reef, its time is limited too. I think he said maybe 100 years, depending on how the temperature rises, because those coral reefs are resilient in comparison to coral reefs that are further south. They seem to be able to tolerate higher temperatures, but just how high is the question.
And you mentioned earlier the sinkholes. Let's talk a bit about that. We're familiar in the United States with sinkholes, and usually those are in limestone areas where, you know, the underground water gets underground and eats away at the rock, and then it collapses. But these are very different kinds of sinkholes, and this looks like a moonscape in some of these places around the Dead Sea. Can you tell us about some of those places?
Yeah, well, the sinkholes are caused not by limestone, but by salt. And there is a salt layer under the surface. And as the sea recedes, the salt layer dries out. And then when there are flash floods, it's flooded with fresh water, and they slowly, the earth above caves in. We spent a lot of time with Carmit Ishalom, who's been spending at least a decade studying these sinkholes, and they still can't figure out exactly, they can't predict when the next one will happen, but they're just happening constantly. There's 6,000 of them, and there, you go to beaches where there used to be a restaurant and places for people to sit, and it's just all caved in and very dangerous areas to walk around. So it's an ongoing process. When we were there, it was 6,000 plus. I don't know what the number is now, but
They say 500 a year. That's like the average.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot of sinkholes each year. 500 a year?
Yeah.
Wow.
If you don't go to the Northern Basin, if you take a different road down to the resorts, or you don't look, if you go down the route that is the direct route to the Dead Sea, you really need to look for it because it's low. You won't necessarily realize what's going on if you're going to go to a resort. And I think a lot of people who go to the resorts have no idea what's happening a few miles away.
Well, we need to talk a bit about the politics behind all this, because on, you know, the West Bank of the Dead Sea, you've got Israel, and then the other side of the sea, you've got Jordan, and of course, Palestine right there nearby in the Palestinian situation, and so much complex and difficult politics in the region. Tell us a bit about, you know, some of the work that has to go on behind the scenes, and maybe some of the work that you had to do to talk to some of these different parties to get everybody to agree to do something like this. It seems to me it's amazing that you can get all these parties involved to agree on a project of this scale.
Well, my sense in meeting different people who worked for different water authorities is that on that level, they're all scientists and they understand the problem. And they cooperate with each other. They are used to cooperating with each other, and they keep politics aside, and water becomes a way they can cooperate with each other. So our experience was meeting with people who understand the importance of cooperation when it comes to the sharing of water in a water scarce region.
In terms of the politics, it's more complicated, of course, as you mentioned. But this project was basically a project that was financed. The feasibility study was financed by the World Bank. So the UN was behind it. And the World Bank got the cooperation of the three governments into the project because the World Bank only does regional project. It doesn't do national projects or binational projects. So there has to be more than two parties to do that. And they're still behind it. I mean, the UN and the World Bank are still behind it. And the governments, at least on paper, are committed to doing that. And of course, as you mentioned, the most pressing partner is Jordan, because their natural water sources are really dwindling. They're overpumping their own water. They don't have a long coastline for desalination projects. They only have one little outlet to the sea, which is in Aqaba. And their water infrastructure is really not in a good shape. They lose a lot of water to bad maintenance of their water system. And they're under a lot of pressure. I mean, they need water.
Yeah, I saw it somewhere. It was like within 40 years, they will run out of water if they don't, do something.
It looks pretty bad for them because they have very limited natural resources of water, which is mainly the underground aquifer. Israel found a solution because, Israel is lucky to have a long coastline with the Mediterranean. So they built five desalination plants and they're pumping water from the sea. Jordan doesn't have an outlet to the sea, so they can do that. So they're under a lot of pressure because they don't have it.
And how does the Palestinians factor into this? Are they going to get access to this water from this project?
According to the agreements between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, Israel sells fresh water to the Palestinian, to the West Bank, and to a certain extent to Gaza. And so that's part of the agreement. And the Palestinians always feel, because they have absolutely no outlet to anywhere to get water, so they get water from the Israeli system, basically. And it's always, there's always a level of tension. Do they get enough? Do they don't get enough? They always want to get more. And then Israel sells the water, so it's the issue of the price, and they're stuck in between because they don't have access to the Mediterranean, and they don't really have access to natural water resources. So they're kind of dependent on the goodwill of others.
I think it's very appropriate that this program is going to be airing right around Earth Day, which is every year around April 20th. I'm curious for both of you, what do you want viewers to take away? What's the big takeaway you want them to get from your film?
Boy, it's a different way to think about climate change. It's a different way to think about the impact we have on the environment. And working on the film got me thinking about that, our role in how we work with the nature around us. And so I've always loved the Dead Sea, and I'm hoping that through this story, people will find out what's going on there, because it's an untold story, and that the project will help people think about our impact on the planet, not necessarily only because of climate change, but because of other things that we do.
For me, I think more like on a universal level, you know, water shortage is a huge problem, not only in the Middle East, not only because of the Dead Sea. I mean, you know, you read what happened in Cape Town in South Africa and other places in the world. There's not enough water. Population is exploding, is growing, and climate change contributes to this, but there's just not enough water. And if humanity starts using water from the sea because other sources are kind of drying out, we don't exactly know how this is going to impact the oceans, the seas, because everybody now runs for desalination, because this is like, you know, this is the go-to solution. But what's going to happen when everybody's going to use water from the sea and then dropping back the brine back into the sea and increasing the salination level of the existing oceans? So I think that, you know, through the lens of what happens in the Dead Sea and what happens in the Middle East, I think that people can realize that water shortage is a big problem.
Anything you want to add to that, Terry?
No, I mean, it's a good point. I was just thinking that Itai Gabrielli, who was the lead scientist in the research for the Dead Sea, Red Sea plan, talked about that a lot. And he said, you know, we're desalinating, but we don't know the impact of that yet. We don't know putting all this brine into the sea exactly what the impact's going to be. So for every move we make to help humanity, we also have to look at the impact on the environment, and it's a very difficult balancing act.
It sounds like both of you love this place, the Dead Sea, and you both have a connection to it, which as filmmakers and storytellers is just a magical thing. It really does help you tell a story when you feel personally connected to it. What was your favorite part of working on this over the last couple of years?
Favorite part. I just loved going there and being able to film the place. I found it quite an extraordinary experience to actually see it when we were filming with a drone. Because you get a drone up there and boy, you can really see what's going on. That was visually a very powerful experience. Being there is just an amazing place. So that was for me. And also going to Jordan, I hadn't been to Jordan before, and I thought it's also, you know, the people were lovely and helpful, and it was great to see what these women are doing to try to help their community.
Yeah, for me, I did a lot of the research phase, and I was there to kind of set it up with a lot of the people. So for me, you know, visiting the place again and see what happened to it, but also meeting the people that live there and work there and do the research and hear from them how concerned they are about what's going to happen there. And like the guy who lives in Kibbutz En Gedi, who's been living there since 1960, and he looks forward and he doesn't know if the place will be able to exist, because everything is kind of like looks like ruin around the place, and it's just getting worse. And it becomes like a big question to these people who live there and love the place, if life will be able to be sustained down there.
Is there anything else you wanted to add, Terry?
No, I don't think so. Okay. You asked a lot of really good questions, though.
I have one last one. Not so much just about this film, but all of your other films. You've made a great niche and have a wonderful career as a filmmaker and making science documentaries, especially some of the ones I've seen on Nova. What is it about making science films, science documentaries, that you personally really find rewarding and enjoy? Why did this become, you think, your niche?
Well, I fell into it. I was not a great science student at all. And I consider it a privilege to be able to sit down with these scientists. And the fact that because it's NOVA and they know the amount of research we're going to do and that we take their work so seriously, that they'll spend a lot of time explaining a subject to me, which is very complex. And I get to learn about things I would never learn about any other way through these extraordinary people. At the Dead Sea, it's people who really care about this place. When I work with, the scientists who are exploring Pluto, it's people who are looking up at the universe and saying, what's our place in it? And how did we get here? And asking all these big questions. And I love hearing what they have to say. And again, I think it's an honor to and a privilege to spend time with them and to bring their stories to the public.
Yeah, I don't know if it's like this for you, but I just imagine it's got to be pretty cool when you turn on the TV and you hear dun, 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 and you know that's my film on Nova.
Well, the melody is ingrained in my brain, but I have a tendency to sort of, do I want to watch it? Do I not want to watch it?
Well, I might have to do a follow-up on this one, because now you've got me totally fascinated by the Dead Sea. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to our guests, Terry Randall and Avner Tavori. Their new film, Saving the Dead Sea, airs on PBS's Nova series on April 24th. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to us on NPR Podcasts via the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Blue Dot is distributed by PRX. That's the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Our producer and engineer is Mr. Blue, Sky Schofield. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.